Let's turn again to the book of Job, chapter 23. Job 23. And read verses 8 through 10. Behold, I go forward, but he is not there, and backward, but I cannot perceive him. On the left hand where he does work, but I cannot behold him. He hides himself on the right hand, that I cannot see him. But he knows the way that I take. When he has tried me, I shall come forth as gold. Where is God in all this? I'm sure you've sometimes asked yourself that question. Maybe a very difficult, perplexing, confusing providence or series of providences. And you look around you and you just say, where's God in all this? This was the question that Job had in the midst of his sufferings, a question they asked in great agony, as you can imagine, considering the number of losses he experienced. You might ask yourself, well, what was the greatest loss for Job? And he had many. He lost family, he lost property, he lost cattle, lost his health. He lost his reputation. But these were not the most painful losses for Job. The most painful loss for Job was the loss of God. Or maybe more accurately to say, a loss of the sense of God. A sense of being abandoned and forsaken by God. That was the core of his agony. Where is God in all this? And he has a wonderful answer for us that I hope will minister to you if you are in these situations. Or maybe if you look back in your life and you see these kinds of times and you remember you had that question and you never got an answer. Well, maybe here you may be able to interpret that time of darkness with new light. Or maybe your life's just gone really well so far and you don't know anything of this. This is a kind of strange idea. Well, you will need this in the years ahead at some point in your life. I don't believe anyone gets through life without coming at one point or other, maybe many times, to say, where's God in all this? Now, Job is a huge book, mostly unexplored. So let me just briefly try and simplify it with a structure that maybe might help you interpret it and read it a bit more easily and with a bit more understanding. It's really divided into three parts. In the first part, you might say there's a controversy between God and the devil. That's chapters 1 and 2. And then in the massive middle part, chapter 3 to 37, you have a controversy between Job and his friends. And they're saying all sorts of cruel and heartless things to him. And then in the last section, chapter 38 to 42, you have a controversy really between God and Job. And we'll note the resolution of that shortly. So, in a way, you might say in the first part, chapters 1 and 2, the devil speaks. In the second part, chapters 3 to 37, man speaks. And in chapters 38 to 42, God speaks. And so we find this chapter somewhat in the middle of that big middle section. Job is in a debate, an argument with his friends, his so-called comforters, miserable comforters, really useless comforters, and he's turning away from them and really appealing to God continually for him to appear to his aid and to deliver him from all the false accusations and aspersions that were being cast on him, and yet silence, nothing, no help. So we come to this passage, and I want to look at it under two headings. First of all, really, as we'll see what Job says, I don't know where God is, and I don't know what God's doing. And then secondly, we want to look at God knows where I am, and God knows what he's doing. So let's look at the puzzle, as it were, first of all, before we get to the solution. I don't know where God is, and I don't know what God's doing. Notice here, first of all, Job really expressing, I don't know where God is. He's searching for the Lord. And I think that's significant. He's not searching for peace or joy or assurance. He's searching not for the benefits, but for the benefactor. Not for the blessings, but for the blesser. It's a very personal search. He's not looking for experiences so much as God himself. And you'll notice here, he's searching everywhere for him. He's searching everywhere for him. You notice, for example, in verse 8, behold, I go forward. He's not there. I go backward. I can't perceive him there. On the left hand, where he usually works, he says, I can't see him. He hides himself on the right hand. So he's saying, no matter where I turn, I go 360 degrees, no God. No evidence, not an atom or a scintilla of evidence of God in my life. He's looking for a little spark, a little chink of light, and there's nothing but darkness. He looks everywhere. And he says, if only I knew where I might find him. You notice that in verse 3. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come even to his seat. He's saying, you know, if somebody came to me and told me God is like 10,000 miles away, I'd go there. If it would mean me finding God. If somebody told me he's at the top of Mount Everest, that's where I'd go. If somebody told me he's at the lowest point on earth, the Dead Sea, that's where I'd go. If I had that knowledge, that's where I would go, because that's who I want. If only I knew where I might find him. And it's amazing, really amazing when you think about this. Job is not a fair weather Christian. He's not seeking for God in the midst of prosperity and blessing. That's easy. He's searching for God in the midst of a storm, the greatest storm perhaps that came across any mere human being on this earth ever. And yet, it's God he wants. He's not blown away by the storm. His faith does not blow away. It's exercised. And yet, as he seeks God, there's nothing. I don't know. I just don't know where God is. And then he goes to say a second thing. I don't know what God's doing. I don't know what he's doing. And there's so many accusations flying against him, so many censures, so much condemnation. And yet he is perfectly innocent. You notice that at the beginning of the book of Job. God tells us this right up front, doesn't he? You look at the words in Job chapter 1. They're truly remarkable words. there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was perfect and upright and one that feared God and eschewed or hated evil. I mean, could you get better words spoken by God of any mere man? You couldn't, could you? God's basically clearing him, vindicating him right up front. And yet what follows in the chapters 3 and following are horrendous accusations from so-called friends, so-called believers against him. And it's agony to him. His reputation, his purity, his godliness, it was very precious to him. Job is reckoned to have been written one of the earliest books of the Bible, and he's probably one of the earliest believers there was ever in the earth. Most commentators believe that he existed even before Moses. And he had very little, therefore, in terms of scripture. And yet, what a remarkable believer to have so little to work on and yet to have such a faith. And so little fellowship, so little means of grace, so little by way of church to encourage him and help him. But there are some friends who come and they start off reasonably well. They don't say a word for 7 days, and that's often a great tactic when you want to comfort someone who's suffering. We're too quick to speak. And so they started off well, but they soon went way off, and they started raining down these accusations against him. And he's in agony with this. And that's what he goes on. Do you see that in verse 3? Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that he might come even to his seat. And he's talking, this word seat here is the word for a judgment throne, a judgment seat. It's a court setting. And he's envisaging here a divine court with God on the bench, with God on the judge's seat. And he said, I would come to that court and I would order my cause before him. I would come and I would set out my arguments. That's what he says. I would fill my mouth with arguments. I would know the words which he would answer me and understand. He's not afraid of God's verdict. Do you see that? He's saying, if I could come and plead my cause and defend myself and plead the Lord's knowledge and omniscience, I know what he'll say. I've got total confidence in his justice, in his truthfulness, in his faithfulness, in his judgeship. I know the words he'll answer me. I'll understand what he would say to me. And then he asks in verse 6, will he plead against me with his great power? Will he take this great power and then use it to crush me even further? Will he take this almightiness and use it to make me a piece of dust? No, he says. He would take that strength and put it to my advantage. Use it for my good and my gain. He would put strength in me. There, he says, the righteous might dispute with him. So should I be delivered forever from my judge. And there the judge that he's speaking of is the human, or the human judges around him. He's saying, I appeal to the divine judge, the source of all justice, who will deliver me from all these judges who are setting themselves up as judges of my character and my faith. But he can't find God. He's saying, if I knew where he was, I'd come, I'd set out my case, I'd fill my mouth with arguments, I would plead, I know what he would say, and I know he'll come alongside me and strengthen me, and he'll condemn my condemners, but I can't find him. He's nowhere to be found. I I don't know what God's doing. When I need him most, where is he? I don't know where God is, and I don't know what God's doing. This is a Christian experience. This is not the experience of an unbeliever. This is someone with true saving faith in God. An unbeliever really couldn't care if God was present with them or not. Especially when things go south, things go bad. Unbelievers, they run away from God. They don't want, see, they knew this is what God was like. That's not Job. And this is a true test of us. When we pass through these deepest, darkest times, do we run to God or run away from him? Do we run to him even when we have no idea where he is and we've got no idea what he's doing? I'm not saying that's the uniform, constant experience of the believer, because Job had low points too. Job had moments of unbelief, but the general tenor of his life, the general pattern was, I don't know where he is, and I don't know what he's doing, but I'm not running away. I'm not giving up. I'm going to keep believing and keep looking. This is a believing experience, and it's a common experience for the believer. It's a common experience. He's not a one-off, Job. He wasn't put in the Bible as an exception. It was the norm, really. Some believers have this kind of experience, maybe many times in their lives. Maybe for extended times of their lives. It's, you might say, normal abnormality in an abnormal world. It's something that shouldn't take us by surprise, therefore. It's a deeply distressing experience, even although you can say, well, you know, I'm in this, and it's been going on for a long time, or this is the umpteenth time, and I know that, I know this is a proof that I am a true believer because I'm not giving up. I'm walking in the darkness and I have no light, but I'm still walking by faith. Regardless of all that, it's still agony. It's still distressing. It's still a fearful experience to be in. It doesn't lessen the pain of this. But it is a deceptive experience, because the conclusion that we might draw from it is, because I cannot sense God's favor and I cannot sense God's love, therefore he has no favor and he has no love towards me. And we've been singing songs like that tonight. And the psalmist is very brutally honest about the reality of his falterings and faintings of faith. He was, like Job at times, drawing conclusions from his senses or his lack of senses rather than from the Word of God and by faith. There are passages in Job that He thinks God has made him his number one enemy, he says. God's strung bolts into his bow and he's just firing one after another at him. That's what it felt like. But that was not what was happening. It was a deceptive experience. It wasn't real. If he could see, as it were, behind the curtain, he would see it wasn't God abandoning him. It's like you see the little boy in the supermarket, the store, who runs away from his mother and then turns around and panics because he can't see her anymore, but the mother sees him all the time. It's not as if she's taken her eye off him. It's just that he doesn't see her eye on him. This is what happened to Job over a much longer period of time than a few seconds. At no point in this whole experience did God take his eye or his heart off Job. Not once. And so what this is telling us is don't trust your feelings in the midst of such a time. Trust the truth that God will never let his people go. No one will pluck them out of his hand. He loves with an everlasting love. He didn't love Job any less in these moments than he did in Job chapter 1 and Job chapter 42. And he doesn't love you any less either, believer, when you're walking in darkness and you have no light. I don't know where God is and I don't know what God's doing, but God knows where I am. And God knows what he's doing. Look at these wonderful words after all the struggles and battles up to verse 9, verse 10. But he knows. He knows the way that I take. And here we notice again these two truths to fight back, these two perceptions. God knows where I am. So, you know, in a sense, does it really matter ultimately if I don't know where God is, if God knows where I am? That's all that matters. Ultimately. I can survive without knowing where God is. I can't survive if God doesn't know where I am. I can't survive if God takes his eye or his heart off me. And this is where Job comes back to, but whatever else I see or sense, don't see, don't sense, know, don't know, he knows. He knows. What does he know? Well, we're told he knows the way that I take. And that could simply mean he knows the path of life that I'm walking in at the present time. He knows exactly where I am. He knows exactly what's been happening. He knows all the pains and agonies. He knows everything that all these so-called friends have said to him. He knows all the disappointments and all the frustrations and all the anger. He knows the way that I take. He knows me externally, he knows me internally, he knows me objectively, he knows me subjectively, he knows my past, my present, my future. He knows the way that I take. So it could simply be a reference, and that's the truth, a reference to the general path of life that I have been and am walking in. He knows everything. You can't see God anywhere, but he sees everything about you. That's a comfort. It's not a terror. But it's interesting that Job develops this idea of way in verses 11 and following to make it as conclude that this is more than God knows the general way of life that Job is having and living. Because notice it says in verse 11, my foot has held his steps, his way have I kept and not declined. Neither have I gone back from the commandment of his lips. I have esteemed the words of his mouth more than my necessary food. And so what Job is really saying here is, he knows the way that I take, meaning he knows that whatever temptations I am having to abandon faith, to walk away from the path of righteousness, I'm going to keep walking by God's grace. That path of righteousness, that path of holy living, that path of faith, I am not turning to the left or to the right. Wherever else I go, whatever else I do, that's my life. I'm holding on. My foot has held his steps. His way I've kept. I have not declined. His commandments, they're still in my lips. His words, they're still in my heart. More than my necessary food. Here's somebody clinging on with the fingernails of faith. With no help in their life to do so. Nothing to encourage them. But he's saying, God, you know I'm still in that path. I'm still seeking you. I'm still walking by your word. Your word is still my guide and my guard. And I will not give that up. It's an incredible confession and affirmation of faith. And a pattern for all who are going through times of affliction. One of the temptations in affliction, especially affliction where you sense God is against you, is just to give up on God. And what Job is saying is, well, there's one thing I know. If I stay in that path, it will ultimately lead me to God. No other path will. There might be some more attractive short-term options, but they aren't leading to God. I know if I keep walking this path, holding these steps, not declining, keep that word of his in my heart, I know that ultimately that's the way I will ultimately come into the light, and the light will come into my life. He's saying, I may be going through the fiery furnace, but if I stay on God's path in the furnace, the path will lead me to God. He knows the way that I take. He knows. For all my faltering and failing and faintings here and there, he knows. That's the general pattern and tenor of my life. And he will meet me on that path. No other path. No other path. You want to meet God again? That's the path. However long it takes, however hard it may be, that's the path. The path of obedience. He knows where I am. And he knows what he's doing. He knows what he's doing. Notice what he says in verse 10. He knows the way that I take. When he has tried me, I shall come forth as gold. And this word try has two meanings. The first one is proving, when he has proven me. And really what's pictured here is, it's like somebody who manufactures something and then says, hands it over to someone and says, put it to the test. Prove how good this is and how good my workmanship is. You know, you might have a child who makes something, maybe a bow and arrow, and they might come, hey, look at how strong, look at how great this bow is. You know, look how far it can pull it right back, and look how far, test it, prove it, because it reflects on the one who made it. And that's at the heart of the book of Job, is a big test. Remember, Satan came to God and, as it were, laid a bet in front of him and said to him, I'll bet you if you take everything away from Job, he will give up. Take it all away and we'll see that Job's not really a believer. He's only in it for what he can get out of it. That was Satan's bet. It was a dare. And God gave him permission. God gave him, he said, take it all away. I give you permission. Let's test this theory. Let's prove this man of God. Let's see what he's really made of. Because of the glory and the honor that accrues to God through this. And that's what the book of Job is all about, and that's how it all climaxes in God proving himself right and proving the devil wrong. Because of what that says about the God who made Job the man he was. When he has tried me. It could be said God hazarded his reputation on Job. But the end result was God's reputation burnished, polished, more lustrous, to the extent that here we are tonight, many thousands of years later, and Job and God especially are still shining so brightly. God's still winning. God's still beating the devil, as it were. And believer, this is one of the most glorious fruits of suffering and affliction. That it's one of the greatest ways that we can burnish and polish the reputation of God in the world. People don't really give a second look to people who are prospering and believing. But they sure give a second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth look to those who are suffering and suffering and suffering and still believing. And it may be that God has chosen you to be a polisher of his name in the world. And for myself as a pastor and in counseling and things like that, my heroes and heroines are sufferers. They don't see it. Of course they don't. But when you see someone who has been through so much darkness, through so much difficulty, has had so much discouragement, maybe going through times of tremendous pain outwardly, inwardly, emotionally, mentally, relationally, and they will not give up. They will not veer from the path. There's nothing more glorious in all the world, is there? These are the polishers of God's glory in the world. They are the ways that God's glory is let into the world. And it's so, so beautiful and worshipful to see this in Job. And I can think of people in previous congregations and in this who have been through the mill, who have been ground down until you think there's nothing left. How can they go another step? How can they live another day? And they do. And they do gloriously and beautifully and awesomely in ways that you cannot but just, yeah, glorify God. God knows what he's doing. It's a tremendous honor. I mean, Job's friends got it completely wrong. Their conclusion was, huh, you're suffering so much, you must be the lowest of the low. And what the book of Job tells us is, the sufferers of God are the highest of the high. They've been chosen for special honor and glory. a unique role. The world doesn't see it, of course. God sees it. He's proving me. But he's doing another thing too. He's improving me. When he has tried me, I shall come forth as gold. There's a purpose. I know it doesn't seem it when you're in the midst of it. It's nothing but meaninglessness, pointlessness. It's just it's full of just question marks multiply in your mind. Darkness envelops you. You end up, you think, can I trust anyone? But there's purpose, and it's a four-letter word, G-O-L-D, gold, gold. Yes, he's in the furnace. Yes, he's been tried, but the end, what comes out at the end is gold. Not just that God is shining, but Job is shining too. When he has tried me, I shall come forth. What confidence there is here. He's saying, I shall come out. However long this goes on for, however deep, however hot, I'm coming out. I know it. There's a date already set for deliverance. In Job's case, it was in this world. As you'll read on in the last chapters, God blessed him far more than he had even before. But that's not always the case for believers. For many believers, the deliverance day is their death day. Yes, they show gold throughout the suffering, and it's beautiful, but that the ultimate presentation of that gold ingot is at death. And they will shine in ways that no others will shine. The sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed, says Paul. The sufferings multiply the glory and the gold. He's improving me. I shall come out, and I shall come out on God's time. When he has tried me, I shall come forth as gold. God, as it were, yes, he has you in the furnace, but his hand is on the thermostat and his eye is on the clock. And he knows exactly how hot to make it and how long to keep you in it. And you won't be in it for 1 degree hotter than it need be and 1 minute longer than it need be. You'll come forth when? When God has decided, and you'll come out better, not worse. It feels worse, but better is the end. So what's Job saying to us here apart from, God knows where I am, God knows what he's doing? He brings us to two conclusions. One is, submit to the sovereignty of God. You see that, for example, in verse 13 and following. But he is of one mind, and who can turn him? And what his soul desires, even that he does. You can't fight this. There's no point. You're not going to win by fighting it. For he performs the thing that's appointed for me. This is his plan. This is his purpose. He's looked at me, and he's tailored these experiences perfectly to me. They wouldn't fit anyone else, but they fit me perfectly. He performs the thing that's appointed for me, and many such things are with him. He's got so many plans for me. God is sovereign. Therefore, submit. And secondly, trust his wisdom. Submit to his sovereignty and trust his wisdom. If he knows, that's all I need to know. If he knows where I am and he knows what he's doing, he's wiser than me and I trust him. I trust. Trust is so key, isn't it? It's so hard, isn't it, in life for any relationships to flourish without trust. And once trust is broken, it's so hard to repair. So hard to repair. It's hard to follow someone you don't trust. But here, Job is saying, he knows, and I trust he knows. I trust he knows where I am. I trust he knows what he's doing with me and for me. Therefore, that's enough. That's enough. The promises here, the encouragement here for God's people is just so immense. So amazing, so precious. But there's nothing here for the unbeliever, is there? The unbeliever could go through this whole world, and it's in the Psalms, you can go through the whole world and have very little trouble, very little trial, very little affliction, relative to God's people. It's a strange fact. But what's after? For the believer, the furnace finishes at death. It may finish before then, but it will never go past death. For the unbeliever, the fire's just about to begin. It's just about to begin. And it may be, well, you say, well, I'm an unbeliever and I've had tough things in my life, and I've heard unbelievers say something like, well, you know, I've had hell on earth. Oh, no, you haven't. Oh, no, you haven't. You haven't begun to know what hell is on earth. You haven't begun to know what hell is at all. A fire that will never go out. A fire that has no love in it, a fire that has no purpose of good in it, a fire that has no limit to the thermostat, and it's got no end in time. That's the fire. What a contrast. Why not learn from this? From Job, you remember these beautiful words he speaks of in Job 19 earlier in this book. I know that my Redeemer lives. That's what changed the furnace for Job. He had a Redeemer. He had a Savior. He's looking ahead to the coming Messiah. He said, I know he lives. And I know he'll raise this broken, bruised, battered body and mind and soul and make it glorious. That's what changes the furnace. From something destructive to something constructive. Seek the Redeemer. Look to Christ. Ask him to come into your life as your Lord and Savior. Even if it means going through furnaces of affliction, well, better a few years of that here with a good purpose than an eternity of it, with no good at the end of it. Yes, like Job, teach you how to endure affliction, but let Job also teach you who to believe in, who to go to, and put your total trust in. He is utterly trustworthy. Men and women, even the best, they'll let you down, but he won't ever let you down. You can trust him totally. You can follow him wholeheartedly. There's nothing like it in all the world to be a follower of Jesus Christ. Let's pray.